sounding louder and more confident, and her face screwed up like she was trying to remember something very exactly.
Shuffle, duffle, muzzle, muff, fister, wister, Mr. Cough.
Now all those present could feel it, heroines and bullies alike, the sensation of some dark will pressing down on them, a tingling in the air as something built, and built, and built. All the blue hazes around the white robes, all the shielding spells had died without any visible hex touching them. There were more flashes of light as more desperate spells were fired, but they fizzled out in midair like candle flames touching water. The black barriers at the two ends of the corridor had dissipated like smoke beneath the growing pressure, but their evaporation revealed the exits sealed, blocked by tiled slats of dark metal that looked stained as though with blood. And as Tracy chanted,
"Lemarchand! Lament! Lemarchand!"
a dreadful blue light began to shine out from beneath the metal slats and between them, and the six sets of double doors slammed shut all at once, as panicked white-robed bullies began to pound on them and howl. Then Tracy's hand slashed to her left and she cried,
"Cornath!"
Then her hand pointed below her and,
"Slarneth!"
Above her,
"Nurgoth!"
And then, to her right,
"Tintichi!"
Tracy paused, took a deep breath, and Hermione found her voice and cried,
"Stop, Tracy! Stop!"
But there was a strange, wild smile on Tracy's face. She raised her hand still higher and snapped her fingers a third time. And when she spoke again, beneath her high girlish voice there was an undertone as though some lower chorus were chanting along with her.
"Darkness beyond darkness, deeper than pitches black, buried beneath the flow of toil, from darkness to darkness, your voice echoes in the emptiness, unknown to death, nor known to life."
"What are you doing?"
shrieked Parvati, and the Gryffindor girl stretched out a hand as though to pull down the Slytherin, who was now starting to float upward into the air, and both Daphne and Susan grabbed Parvati's arm at the same time, and Daphne cried out,
"Don't! We don't know what will happen if the ritual's interrupted!"
"What the hell happens if it gets completed?"
screamed Hermione, as close as she'd ever come to total brain meltdown. Susan's face was white as chalk as she whispered,
"I'm sorry, Mad-Eye."
And Tracy spoke on, her body floating higher and higher off the floor, her black hair whipping wildly around her in the chill winds.
"You who know the gate, who are the gate, the key and guardian of the gate, I bid you open the way for him and manifest his power before me."
The corridor was plunged then into utter darkness and silence, so that only Tracy could be seen and heard, like there was nothing left in the universe except her and the light illuminating her from some nameless source. The Shining Girl raised her hand one final time and with dreadful gravity pressed her thumb and forefinger together. And within the darkness, Hermione looked at Tracy's face and saw that the Slytherin girl's eyes were now, to the exact shade, the green of Harry Potter's.
Harry James Potter Evans Veris! Harry James Potter Evans Veris! Harry James Potter Evans Veris!
There was a snap like thunder, and then... Harry had chosen to assume a rather relaxed posture as he sat in a low chair before the mighty desk of the headmaster of Hogwarts, one leg cocked over his knee, and his arms sprawled casually to either side. Harry was doing his best to disregard the noise from the surrounding devices, although the one directly behind him that sounded like an owl hooting desperately as it was put through a wood chipper was pretty difficult to ignore.
"Harry,"
the old wizard said from behind the desk, the aged voice level as the blue eyes stared out at him from beneath the shining half-moon spectacles. Headmaster Dumbledore had garbed himself in robes of midnight purple, not true formal black, but dark enough to come close indeed to deadly serious, as the wizarding world counted in the meaning of fashions.
"Were you responsible for this?"
"I cannot deny that my influence was at work," Harry said.
The old wizard took off his glasses, leaned forward to stare at Harry directly, blue eyes to green.
"I will ask you one question,"
the headmaster said in a quiet voice.
"Do you think that what you did today was appropriate?"
"They were bullies, and they came to that hallway with the direct intent of hurting Hermione Granger and seven other first-year children,"
Harry said levelly.
"If I'm not too young for moral judgment, then neither are they. No, Headmaster, they didn't deserve to die, but they did deserve to be stripped naked and glued to the ceiling."
The old wizard put his glasses back on. For the first time that Harry had seen of him, the headmaster seemed to be at a loss for words.
"As Merlin himself is my witness," said Dumbledore, "I haven't the faintest notion of how I ought to react to this."
That's pretty much the effect I was aiming for," said Harry.
He felt like he ought to be whistling a merry tune, but unfortunately he had never learned how to whistle reliably.
"I need not ask you who is directly responsible," said the headmaster. "Only three wizards within Hogwarts might be powerful enough. I myself did not do it. Severus has assured me he was not involved. And the third..."
The headmaster shook his head in some dismay.
"You loaned the defense professor your cloak, Harry. I do not think that was wise, for now that he has escaped detection by simple charms, he surely knows that it is a deathly hallow. If, indeed, he did not know from its first touch upon his flesh."
"Professor Quirrell had already deduced my possession of an invisibility cloak,"
Harry said,
"and knowing him, he has probably guessed that it's a deathly hallow. But in this case, Headmaster, it so happens that Professor Quirrell was under one of those face-concealing white robes."
There was another pause.
"How very cunning,"
said the headmaster. He leaned back in his throne and sighed.
Ah, oh, I have spoken to the defense professor, just before you, indeed. I did not quite know what to say. I told him that this was not the approved Hogwarts policy for dealing with infractions of hallway discipline, and that I did not feel it was appropriate for a Hogwarts professor to do what he had done.
"And what did Professor Quirrell say to that?"
said Harry, who was not impressed with Hogwarts' current policies for enforcing hallway discipline. The headmaster wore a look of resignation.
"He said, 'Fire me.'"
Somehow, Harry managed not to cheer out loud. The headmaster frowned.
"But why did he do it, Harry?"
"Because Professor Quirrell doesn't like school bullies, and I asked very politely," said Harry. "And he was feeling bored, and I thought this might cheer him up. Either that, or it's part of some incredibly deep plot."
The headmaster rose up from behind the desk, began to pace back and forth before the hat stand that held the sorting hat and the red slippers.
"Harry, do you not feel that all of this has gotten a bit...
awesome?"
offered Harry.
"Utterly and completely out of hand, would say it better," said Dumbledore. "I'm not sure there has ever been a time in the whole history of this school when things have become so... I don't have a word for this, Harry, because things have never become like this before, and so no one has ever needed to invent a word for it."
Harry would have tried to invent words to express how deeply complimented he felt, if he hadn't been snarkling too hard to speak. The headmaster was regarding him with increasing graveness.
"Harry, do you understand at all why I find these events concerning?"
Honestly, said Harry, "no, not really. I mean, of course, Professor McGonagall would object to anything that breaks up the dull monotony of the Hogwarts school experience, but then Professor McGonagall wouldn't set a chicken on fire."
The frown lines deepened on Dumbledore's wrinkled face.
"That, Harry, is not what disturbs me,"
the headmaster said quietly.
"There was a full battle fought in these halls."
"Headmaster,"
Harry said, trying to keep his voice carefully respectful,
"Professor Quirrell and I didn't choose for that battle to happen. The bullies did that. We just decided to have the light side win. I know there are times where the boundaries of morality are uncertain, but in this case, the line separating the villains and the heroines was 20 meters tall and drawn in white fire. Our intervention may have been weird, but it certainly wasn't wrong."
Dumbledore had gone back to his desk, sat down in his padded throne with a dull thump, and was now covering his face with both his hands.
"Am I missing something here?"
Harry said.
"I thought you'd be secretly on our side, Headmaster. It was the Gryffindor thing to do. The Weasley twins would approve. Fawkes would approve."
Harry glanced at the golden perch, but it was empty. Either the Phoenix had more important things to do, or the headmaster hadn't invited him to today's meeting.
"That,"
said the headmaster in an old and tired and somewhat muffled voice,
is precisely the problem, Harry. There is a reason why courageous young heroes are not put in charge of schools.
All right,
Harry said. He couldn't quite keep the skepticism out of his voice.
What am I missing this time?
The old wizard lifted his head, his face now solemn and calmer.
Listen, Harry, said Dumbledore. Hear me well, for all who wield power must learn this in time. Some things in this world are indeed truly simple. If you pick up a stone and drop it again, the earth will be no heavier for it. The stars will not move from their paths. I say this, Harry, so that you know I am not pretending to be wise. When I tell you that even as some things are simple, others are complex. There are greater wizardries which leave marks upon the world, and marks upon those who wield them, as a simple charm would not. Those wizardries demand hesitation, consideration of consequence, a moment to weigh the meaning of their marks. And yet, the most intricate magics known to me are simpler than the simplest soul. People, Harry, people are always marked by what they do and by what is done to them. Do you, then, understand how to say, here is the line between hero and villain? It's not enough to say that what you did was right.
Headmaster,
Harry said evenly,
this is not a decision I made at random. No, I don't know what exact effect this will have on every single one of the bullies present, but if I always waited for perfect information before I acted, I'd never do anything. When it comes to the future psychological development of, say, Peregrine Derrick, beating up 8 first-year girls probably wouldn't have been good for him. And it wasn't enough to just stop them quietly and quickly, since then they would just try again later. They had to see that there was a protective power worth fearing.
Harry's voice stayed level.
But, of course, since I am a good guy, I didn't want to permanently injure them or even cause them any pain, and yet the penalty had to be enough to weigh on the minds of anyone thinking about trying it again. So, after weighing the expected outcomes as best I could with my boundedly rational intellect, I thought it would be wisest to strip the bullies naked and glue them to the ceiling.
The young hero stared directly into the old wizard's gaze, unflinching green eyes locked with the blue behind the spectacles.
And since I wasn't there and didn't do anything personally, there's no lawful way to punish me under the Hogwarts school rules. The only one who acted was Professor Quirrell, and he's fireproof. And just breaking the rules to get at me wouldn't be a wise thing to do to the hero you're grooming to fight Lord Voldemort.
This time, Harry actually had tried to think through all the ramifications in advance, before he made the suggestion to Professor Quirrell, and for once, the defense professor hadn't called him a fool, just slowly smiled, and then began to laugh.
I understand your intentions, Harry, the old wizard said. You think you have taught the bullies of Hogwarts a lesson, but if Peregrine Derrick could learn that lesson, he would not be Peregrine Derrick. He will only be provoked more by what you do. It is not fair. It is not right. But that is the way of it.
The old wizard closed his eyes, as though in brief pain, and then opened them again.
Harry, the most painful truth any hero must learn is that the right cannot, should not, must not win every battle. All of this began when Miss Granger fought 3 older enemies and won. If she had been content with this, the echoes of her deed would have died away in time. Yet, instead, she banded together with her classmates and raised her wand in open challenge to Peregrine Derrick and all his kind. And his kind cannot but raise their own wands in answer. So, Jamie Astorga went hunting her, and in the natural course he would have beaten her. It would have been a sad day, but it would have ended there. There is not enough magic in 8 first-year witches altogether to defeat such a foe. But you could not accept that, Harry. Could not let Miss Granger learn her own lessons. And so you sent the defense professor to watch over them invisibly, and pierce Astorga's shield when Daphne Greengrass struck at him.
What?
thought Harry. The old wizard went on speaking.
Each time you intervened, Harry, it escalated matters further, and yet further. Soon, Miss Granger was facing Robert Chugson himself, the son of a Death Eater, with 2 strong allies at his side. Painful indeed it would have been for her if Miss Granger had lost that battle. And yet again, by your will and Quirinus's hand, this time, shown more openly, she won.
Harry was still struggling with the notion of the defense professor watching invisibly over Spew, guarding the heroines from harm.
And so,
the old wizard finished,
that is how we came to today, Harry. 244 students attacking 8 first-year witches. A full battle in these halls. I know it was not your intent, but you must accept some measure of responsibility. Such things did not happen before you came to this school, not through all my decades in Hogwarts, neither when I was a student, nor when I was a professor.
Thank you very much,
Harry said evenly.
Though I think Professor Quirrell deserves more credit than me.
The blue eyes widened.
Harry!
Those bullies were attacking victims long before this year,
Harry said. Despite his best efforts, his voice was starting to rise.
But nobody seems to have taught the students that they're allowed to fight back. I know it's much harder to ignore a 2-sided fight than some helpless victims getting hexed or almost pushed out of windows, but it's not exactly worse, is it? I wish I'd read more of Godric Gryffindor's writing so I could quote him. There's got to be something in there about this. Open battle may be louder than the victims suffering in silence. It may be harder to pretend that nothing's happening, but the final result is better.
No, it is not,
Dumbledore said.
It is not, Harry. To always fight the darkness, to never let evil pass unchallenged, that is not heroism, but simple pride. Even Godric Gryffindor did not think that every war was worth fighting, though he went his whole life from one battle to another.
The old wizard's voice went quieter.
In truth, Harry, the words you speak are not evil. No, not evil. And yet they have frightened me. You are one who might some day wield great power over wizardry, over your fellow wizards. And if, come that day, you still think evil must never pass unchallenged.
Now a note of real worry had entered the headmaster's voice.
The world has grown more fragile since the age when Hogwarts was raised. I fear it cannot bear the fury of another Godric Gryffindor. And he was slower to his wrath than you.
The old wizard shook his head.
You are too ready to fight, Harry. Much too ready to fight. And Hogwarts itself is becoming a more violent place around you.
Well,
Harry said carefully after weighing his words,
I don't know if it will help to say this, but I think you're getting the wrong impression of what I'm all about. I don't like real fighting either. It's scary and violent and somebody might get hurt. But I didn't fight today, Headmaster.
The Headmaster frowned.
You sent the Defense Professor in your place.
Professor Quirrell didn't do any fighting either,
Harry said calmly.
There wasn't anyone there strong enough to fight him. What happened today wasn't fighting. It was winning.
It was a while, then, before the old wizard spoke.
That may be as it may be,
the headmaster said.
But all these conflicts must end. I can hear the strain in the air, and with each of these clashes it rises. All this must end decisively, and soon. You must not stand in the way of its ending.
The old wizard gestured toward the great oaken door of his office, and Harry departed through it. It was with some surprise that Harry stepped out from between the huge grey gargoyles which had made way for him, and saw that Quirinus Quirrell was still slumped against the stone of the corridor wall, a thick thread of spittle drooling from his slack mouth onto his professorial robes, in just the same position he'd occupied when Harry had first gone up into the headmaster's office. Harry waited, but the slumped man didn't rise up, and after long, awkward seconds, Harry began to walk down the corridor again.
Mr. Potter,
came a soft call after Harry had turned two corners, a quiet voice carrying unnaturally through the halls. When Harry had returned, he found Professor Quirrell still slumped against the wall, but the pale eyes now watched him with keen intelligence.
I'm sorry to have tired you out.
It was something that Harry couldn't say. He'd noticed the correlation between the effort Professor Quirrell expended and the time he had to spend resting. But Harry had reasoned that if the effort was too painful or detrimental, surely Professor Quirrell would just say no. Now Harry was wondering if that reasoning had actually been correct, and if not, how to apologize. The defense professor spoke in a quiet voice, the rest of the body unmoving.
How went your meeting with the headmaster, Mr. Potter?
I'm not sure, Harry said. not the way I predicted. He seems to believe the light should lose a lot more often than I'd consider wise. Plus, I'm not sure he understands the difference between trying to fight and trying to win. It explains a lot, actually.
Harry hadn't read much about the Wizarding War, but he'd read enough to know that the good guys probably had acquired a pretty accurate picture of who most of the worst Death Eaters were, and hadn't just owled them all hand grenades over the course of 5 minutes. A soft, soft laugh from the pale lips.
Dumbledore does not comprehend the enjoyment of winning, just as he does not comprehend the enjoyment of the game. Tell me, Mr. Potter, did you suggest this little plan with the deliberate intention of relieving my tedium?
That was among my many motives, Harry said, because some instinct had warned that he couldn't just say yes.
Do you know, the defense professor said in soft, reflective tones, there are those who have tried to soften my darker moods, and those who have indeed participated in brightening my day. But you are the first person ever to succeed in doing it deliberately.
The defense professor seemed to straighten up from the wall with a peculiar motion which might have included magic as well as muscle. And the defense professor began to walk away without a look back in Harry's direction. Only a small gesture of one finger indicated that Harry was to follow.
I particularly enjoyed that chant you composed for Miss Davis, said Professor Quirrell after they had walked a short distance. Though you might have been wiser to consult me in advance before giving it to her to memorize.
One hand bestirred itself to within the defense professor's robes and drew forth a wand which traced a small gesture in the air, after which all the faraway sounds of the castle Hogwarts fell silent.
Tell me honestly, Mr. Potter, have you somehow acquired a familiarity with the theory of dark rituals? That is not the same as confessing an intent to cast them. Many wizards know the principles.
No,
Harry said slowly. He had decided some time ago against trying to sneak into the restricted section of the Hogwarts library, for much the same reason he'd decided a year earlier not to look up how to make explosives out of common household materials. Harry prided himself on at least having more sense than people thought he did.
"Oh," said Professor Quirrell.
The man was walking more normally now, and the lips curved about in a peculiar smile.
"Why, perhaps you possess a natural talent for the field, then?"
"Yes, well," Harry said wearily, "I suppose Dr. Seuss also had a natural talent for dark rituals, because the part about shuffle, duffle, muzzle, muff came from a children's book called Bartholomew and the Oobleck."
"Not that part," said Professor Quirrell. His voice grew a little stronger,
took on some of its normal lecturing tone.
"An ordinary charm, Mr. Potter, can be cast merely by speaking certain words, making precise motions of the wand, expending some of your own strength. Even powerful spells may be invoked in this way, if the magic is efficient as well as efficacious. But with the greatest of magics, speech alone does not suffice to give them structure. You must perform specific actions, make significant choices." nor is the temporary expenditure of your own strength sufficient to set them in motion. A ritual requires permanent sacrifice. The power of such a greater spell, compared to ordinary charms, can be like day compared to night. But many rituals, indeed most, happen to demand at least one sacrifice which might inspire squeamishness. And so the entire field of ritual magic, containing all the furthest and most interesting reaches of wizardry, is widely regarded as dark, with a few exceptions carved out by tradition, of course.
Professor Quirrell's voice took on a sardonic tinge.
The unbreakable vow is too useful to certain wealthy houses to be outlawed entirely. Even though to bind a man's will through all his days is indeed a dread and terrible act, more fearsome than many lesser rituals that wizards shun. A cynic might conclude that which rituals are prohibited is not so much a matter of morality as habit. But I digress.
Professor Quirrell made a brief coughing sound, a clearing of his throat.
The unbreakable vow requires three participants and three sacrifices. The one who receives the unbreakable vow must be the one who could have come to trust the vower, but chooses instead to demand the vow from them, and they sacrifice that possibility of trust. The one who makes the vow must be someone who could have chosen to do what the vow demands of them, and they sacrifice that capacity for choice. And the third wizard, the binder, permanently sacrifices a small portion of their own magic to sustain the vow forever.
Ah, Harry said. I'd wondered why that spell wasn't used all over the place, every time two people have difficulty trusting each other. Although, why don't wizards on their deathbeds charge money to bind unbreakable vows, and use that to leave an inheritance for their children?
Because they are stupid, said Professor Quirrell. There are hundreds of useful rituals which could be performed if men had so much sense. I could name 20 without stopping to draw breath. But in any case, Mr. Potter, the thing about such rituals, whether or not you choose to term them dark, is that they are shaped to be magically efficacious, not to appear impressive when performed. I suppose there is a certain tendency for the more powerful rituals to require more dreadful sacrifices. Even so, the most terrible ritual known to me demands only a rope which has hanged a man and a sword which has slain a woman. And that for a ritual which promised to summon death itself. Though what is truly meant by that I do not know, and do not care to discover, since it was also said that the counterspell to dismiss death had been lost. The most dread chant I have encountered does not sound even as hundredth as fearsome as the chant you composed for Miss Davis. Those among the bullies, who had a passing familiarity with dark rituals, and I am certain that there were some, must have been terrified beyond the capacity of words to describe. If there existed a true ritual which appeared that impressive, Mr. Potter, it would melt the earth.
Said Harry.
Professor Quirrell's lips twisted further.
"Ah, but the truly amusing thing was this. You see, Mr. Potter, the chant of every ritual names that which is to be sacrificed and that which is to be gained. The chant which you gave to Miss Davis spoke first of a darkness beyond darkness, buried beneath the flow of time, which knows the gate and is the gate. And the second thing spoken of, Mr. Potter, was the manifestation of your own presence. And always, in each element of the ritual, first is named that which is sacrificed, and then is said the use commanded of it."
"I see," said Harry, as he trod through the halls of Hogwarts after Professor Quirrell, following him toward the defense professor's office. "So, my chant, the way I wrote it, implies that the outer god Yogg-Sothoth
was permanently sacrificed in a ritual which but briefly manifested your presence," said Professor Quirrell. "I suppose we will discover tomorrow whether anyone took that seriously, when we read the newspapers and see whether all the magical nations of the world are banding together in a desperate effort to seal off your incursion into our reality."
They walked on as the defense professor began chuckling. Odd, throaty sounds. The two of them didn't talk after that until they came to the defense professor's office, and then the man halted with his hand upon the door.
"It is a very strange thing," the defense professor said, his voice now soft again, almost inaudible.
The man was not looking at Harry, and Harry saw only his back.
"A very strange thing. There was a time when I would have sacrificed a finger from my wand hand to work upon the bullies of Hogwarts as we have worked upon them this day, to make them fear me as they now fear you, to have the deference of all the students and the adoration of many. I would have given my finger for that. You have everything now that I wanted then. All that I know of human nature says that I should hate you. And yet I do not. It is a very strange thing."
It should have been a touching moment, but instead Harry felt a coldness travelling down his spine, as though he were a little fish in the sea, and some vast white shark had just looked him over and decided, after a visible hesitation, not to eat him. The man opened the door to the defense professor's office, and passed within, and was gone.
Aftermath.
Her fellow Slytherins were looking at Daphne like they didn't have the faintest idea of how to look at her. The Gryffindors were looking at her like they didn't have the faintest idea of how to look at her. Showing no fear, Daphne Greengrass strode into the potions classroom, wrapped in the imperious dignity of a noble and most ancient house. Inside, she was feeling much the same way everyone else probably did. It had been 2 hours since the "what?" when the "what?" had happened, and Daphne's brain was still going, "What? What? What?" The classroom was quiet as they all waited for Professor Snape to arrive. Lavender and Pavati sat near a cluster of other Gryffindors, surrounded by silent stares. The two of them were looking over each other's homework before class started, and nobody else was helping them or talking to them. Even Lavender, who Daphne would have sworn could never be fazed by anything, seemed subdued. Daphne sat down at her desk and took magical drafts and potions out of her bag and began looking over her own homework, doing her very best to act normal. People stared at her and said nothing. A gasp went through the whole classroom. Girls and boys flinched back, leaning away from the door like they were stalks of wheat touched by a gust of wind. In the door stood Tracy Davis, wrapped in a black tattered cloak which had been draped over her Hogwarts uniform. Tracy walked slowly into the classroom, swaying slightly with each step, looking like she was trying to drift. She sat down at her accustomed desk, which happened to be right next to Daphne's.
"See?"
the Slytherin girl said in a low, sepulchral tone.
"I told you I'd get him before she did."
"What?" blurted Daphne, who immediately wished she hadn't said anything.
"I got Harry Potter before Granger did."
Tracy's voice was still low, but her eyes were gleaming with triumph.
"See, Daphne, what General Potter wants in a girl isn't a pretty face or a pretty dress. He wants a girl willing to channel his dread powers. That's what he wants. Now I'm his, and he's mine."
This announcement produced a frozen silence through the whole classroom.
"Excuse me, Miss Davis," said the cultured voice of Draco Malfoy, who seemed unconcerned as he shuffled through his own potions parchment.
The other scion of a most ancient house didn't so much as glance up from his desk, even as everyone else turned to look at him.
"Did Harry Potter actually tell you that, using those words?"
"Well, no,"
Tracy said, and then her eyes flashed angrily.
"But he'd better take me in now that I've sacrificed my soul to him and everything." "You sacrificed your soul to Harry Potter?"
gasped Millicent. There was a clatter from the other side of the room as Ron Weasley dropped his inkwell.
"Well, I'm pretty sure I did,"
said Tracy, sounding briefly uncertain before she rallied.
"I mean, I looked at myself in a mirror, and I look paler now, and I can always feel darkness surrounding me, and I was a conduit for his dread powers and everything. Daphne, you also saw my eyes go green, right? I didn't see it myself, but that's what I heard afterward."
There was a pause, broken only by the sounds of Ron Weasley trying to clean up his desk.
"Daphne,"
said Tracy.
"I don't believe it,"
said an angry voice.
"There's no way the next Dark Lord would take you to be his bride."
Slowly, and with considerable disbelief, heads turned to stare at Pansy Parkinson.
"Hush, you,"
said Tracy.
"Or I'll..."
The Slytherin girl paused. Then Tracy's voice went even lower, and she said,
"Hush, you, or I'll devour your soul." "You can't do that,"
said Pansy, in the confident tones of a hen which had worked out a perfectly good pecking order where she was at the top and wasn't about to go updating that belief based on mere evidence. Slowly, like she was trying to float, Tracy got up from her desk. There were more gasps. Daphne felt like she had been petrified in place within her chair.
"Tracy,"
said Lavender in a small voice,
"please, don't do all that again. Please."
Now Pansy was showing definite nervousness as Tracy swayed toward her desk.
"What do you think you're doing?"
Pansy said, not quite managing to sound indignant.
"I told you,"
Tracy said menacingly.
"I'm going to devour your soul."
Tracy bent down over Pansy, who sat frozen at her desk, and, with their lips almost touching, made a loud inhaling noise.
"There,"
said Tracy as she straightened.
"I ate your soul."
"No, you didn't," said Pansy.
"Did too," said Tracy.
There was a very slight pause.
"Merlin, she did,"
cried Theodore Knott.
"You look all pale now, and your eyes seem empty."
"What?"
screeched Pansy, turning pale. The girl leapt up from her desk and began frantically rummaging through her book bag. After Pansy drew out a mirror and looked at herself, she turned even paler. Daphne abandoned all pretense of aristocratic poise and let her head fall to the desk with a dull thud, as she wondered whether going to the same school as all the other important families was really worth going to the same school as the Chaos Legion.
"Oh, you're in trouble now, Pansy," said Seamus Finnegan. "I don't know exactly what happens when a Dementor kisses you, but if Tracy Davis kisses you, that's probably even worse."
"Oh, I've heard about people without souls," Dean Thomas said gloomily. "They have to dress all in black, and they write awful poetry, and nothing ever makes them happy. They're all angsty."
"I don't want to be angsty," cried Pansy.
"Too bad," said Dean Thomas. "You've got to be now that your soul's gone."
Pansy turned and stretched out a begging hand toward Draco Malfoy's desk.
"Draco,"
she said pleadingly.
"Mr. Malfoy, please make Tracy give me back my soul."
"I can't," said Tracy. "I ate it."
"Make her throw it up,"
yelled Pansy. The heir of Malfoy had slumped forward, resting his head in both hands so that nobody could see his face.
"Why is my life like this?" said Draco Malfoy.
A wild babble of whispers started up as Tracy returned to her desk, now smiling in satisfaction, while Pansy stood in the midst of the classroom, wringing her hands and tears starting from her eyes.
"Be quiet."
The soft, lethal voice seemed to fill the whole classroom as Professor Snape stalked in through the door. His face was angrier than Daphne had ever seen it, sending a jolt of genuine fear down her spine. Hastily, she looked down at her homework.
"Sit down, Parkinson," the potions master hissed. "And you, Davis, take off that ridiculous cloak."
"Professor Snape!"
wailed Pansy Parkinson in tears.
"Tracy ate my soul!"
Chapter 75. Self-actualization, final responsibility. It was a looping, meandering alley in the midst of Hogwarts, wandering like a stray lock of hair, sometimes crossing itself, it seemed, but you couldn't ever get to the end if you gave in to the temptation of apparent shortcuts. At the end of the tangle, six students leaned against rough stones, robes black against the grey walls and trimmed in green, eyes darting from one to each other. Torches burned in the windowless sconce, casting light to ward off the darkness and heat to ward off the chill of the Slytherin dungeons.
"I am certain," Rhys Belka snapped. "Absolutely certain that was no true ritual. Little thirsty witches can't do that kind of magic, and even if they could, who's ever heard of a dark ritual which sacrifices a sealed horror for that?"
"Were you," said Lucian Boole, "I mean, after that girl snapped her fingers..."
Belka's glare should have melted him.
"No,"
she spat, "I was not."
"That is, she wasn't naked," drawled Marcus Flint, his broad shoulders leaning back in apparent relaxation against the lumpy stone surface. "Covered in chocolate frosting, yes, but not naked. This day, Potter has offered great insult to our houses," said the grim voice of Jamie Astorga.
"Yes, well, I'm sorry to be blunt," Randolph Lee said evenly.
The seventh-year duelist rubbed at his chin where a faint fuzz of beard had been allowed to grow.
"But when someone sticks you to the ceiling, it's a message, Astorga. It's a message which says, I'm an incredibly powerful dark wizard who could have done anything to you I damn well pleased, and I don't care if your house is offended either."
Robert Jugson III gave a soft, low laugh at this, a chuckle that sent chills down several spines.
"It makes you wonder if you picked the wrong side, doesn't it? I've heard tales about messages like that, sent to the old Dark Lord's bidding."
"I'm not ready to kneel to Potter just yet," said Astorga, staring hard into Jugson's eyes.
"Neither am I," said Belka.
Jugson was holding his wand, and he turned it idly back and forth in his fingers, pointing it up and then downward.
"Are you a Gryffindor or a Slytherin?" said Jugson. "Everyone's got a price. Everyone smart."
This statement produced a moment of silence.
"Shouldn't Malfoy be here?"
Boole said tentatively. Flint gave a dismissive flick of his fingers.
"Whatever Malfoy is plotting, he wants to put on an air of innocence. He can't be seen missing at the same time as us."
"But everyone knows that already," said Boole, "even in the other houses."
"Yes, very clumsy," said Belka.
She snorted.
"Malfoy or no, he's just a little thirsty, and we don't need him here."
"I'll owl my father," Jugson said softly, "and he will speak to Lord Malfoy himself."
Abruptly, Jugson stopped speaking.
"I don't know about you, dearies,"
Belka said with fake sweetness,
"but I don't plan on running scared from a false ritual, and
I'm not done with Potter and his pet mudblood.
Nobody answered. All their gazes were looking past her. Slowly, Belka turned around to see what the others were staring at.
You will do nothing,
hissed their head of house. Severus Snape's face was enraged. When he spoke, small spots of spittle flew from his mouth, further dotting his already dirtied robes.
You fools have done enough. You have embarrassed my house, lost to first years. Now you speak of embroiling noble lords of the Wizengamot in your pathetic, childish squabbles. I shall deal with this matter. You will not embarrass this house again. You will not risk embarrassing this house again. You are done with fighting witches, and if I hear otherwise...
If you thought they'd be sitting next to each other at dinner time after that, you'd be quite mistaken. If you thought they'd be sitting next to each other at dinner time after that, you'd be quite mistaken.
What does she want from me?
Came the plaintive cry of a boy who, for all his extensive reading in the scientific literature, was still a bit naive about certain things.
Did she want to get beaten up?
The upper-year Ravenclaw boys, who'd sat down next to him at the dinner table, exchanged swift glances with each other until, by some unspoken protocol, the most experienced of their number spoke.
"Look," said Artie Gray, the seventh year who was leading in their competition by 3 witches and a defense professor.
"The thing you've got to understand is... just because she's angry doesn't mean you lost points. Miss Granger is angry because she got all frightened, and you're there to be blamed. You understand? But, at the same time, even though she won't admit it, she'll be touched that her boyfriend went to such ridiculous and frankly insane lengths to protect her."
"This is not about points,"
ground out Harry Potter, the words visibly escaping from between his clenched teeth. Dinner sat ignored on the table in front of him.
"This is about justice, and I am not her boyfriend."
This was met by a certain amount of sniggering from all present.
"Yeah, well," said a sixth-year Ravenclaw boy, "I think after she kisses you to bring you out of dementation and you stick 44 bullies to the ceiling for her, we've gone way past she's not my girlfriend, really, and into the question of what your kids will be like. Wow, that's a scary thought."
The Ravenclaw trailed off and then said, in a smaller voice,
"Oh, please don't look at me like that."
"Look," said Artie Gray, "I'm sorry to be blunt about this, but you can have justice, or you can have girls. You can't have both at the same time."
He clapped a companionable hand on Harry Potter's shoulder.
"You've got potential, kid. More potential than any wizard I've ever seen. But you've got to learn how to use it, you know? Be a bit sweeter to them. Learn some spells to clean up that mess you call air. Above all, you need to hide your evilness better. Not too well, but
better. Nice, well-groomed boys get girls. And dark wizards also get girls. But nice, well-groomed boys suspected of being secretly dark get more girls than you can imagine.
Not interested,
Harry said flatly as he picked up the boy's hand from his shoulder and unceremoniously dropped it.
But you will be,
said Artie Grey, his voice low and foreboding.
Ah, you will be.
Elsewhere, along the same table...
Romantic!
Shrieked Hermione Granger so loudly that some of the girls next to her winced.
What part of that was romantic? He didn't ask. He never asks. He just sends ghosts after people and glues them to ceilings and does whatever he wants with my life.
But don't you see?
Said a fourth-year witch.
It means that even though he's evil, he loves you. You're not helping,
said Penelope Clearwater a little further down the table, but she was ignored. Several older witches had started toward Hermione after she sat down at the extreme opposite end of the table from Harry Potter, but then a swifter cloud of younger girls had surrounded Hermione in an impenetrable barrier.
Boys, said Hermione Granger, should not be allowed to love girls without asking them first. This is true in a number of ways, and especially when it comes to gluing people to the ceiling.
This was also ignored.
It's just like a play,
sighed a third-year girl.
A play?
Said Hermione.
I'd like to see the play where anything like this happens.
Oh, said the third-year girl. I was thinking of this really romantic one, where there's this very nice sweet boy who makes a flu call, only he mispronounces his destination and stumbles out into this room full of dark wizards who are performing a forbidden ritual that should have stayed forever lost to time. And they're sacrificing 7 victims in order to unseal this ancient horror which is supposed to grant someone a wish if it's freed. So, of course, the boy's presence interrupts the ritual, and as the horror is eating all the dark wizards and everyone's dying, the boy's last thought is that he wishes he could have had a girlfriend. And the next thing you know, the boy's lying in the lap of this beautiful woman whose eyes are burning with a dreadful light. Only she doesn't understand anything about being human, so the boy always has to stop her eating people. This is just like that play. Only you're the boy and Harry Potter's the girl.
That,
Hermione said, feeling quite surprised.
That actually does sound something like... It does?
Blurted a second-year girl sitting across the table, who was now leaning forward, looking horrified and yet even more fascinated.
No,
said Hermione.
I mean, he's not my boyfriend.
2 seconds later... Hermione's ears caught up with what her lips had just said. The fourth-year witch put her hand on Hermione's shoulder and gave her a comforting squeeze.
"Miss Granger," she said in a soothing voice, "I think if you're really honest with yourself, you'll admit that the real reason you're angry with your dark master is that he channeled his unspeakable powers through Tracy Davis instead of you."
Hermione's mouth opened, but her throat locked up before the words came out. Which was probably a good thing, because if she'd actually yelled that loudly, it would have broken something.
"How's that possible, actually?"
said the third-year girl.
I mean, for Harry Potter to work through another girl, even though he's bound himself to you. Do the three of you have one of those, you know, arrangements?
Said Hermione Granger, her throat still locked, her brain halted, and her vocal cords spontaneously making a noise like she was coughing up a yak.
Later.
I don't understand why you're being so unreasonable,
said another second-year witch who'd replaced the third-year girl after Hermione had threatened to ask Tracy to eat her soul.
I mean, really, if someone like Harry Potter rescued me, I'd be sending him thank you cards and hugging him and...
The girl's face was a bit red.
Well, kissing him, I'd hope. Yeah,
said the other second-year witch.
I've never understood why girls in plays get angry when the main character goes out of his way to be nice to them. I wouldn't act like that if the hero liked me.
Hermione Granger had dropped her head to the dinner table, her hands slowly pulling at her hair.
You just don't understand male psychology,
the fourth-year witch said in an authoritative voice.
Granger's got to make it look like she can mysteriously resist his seductive charm.
Even later.
And so before long, Hermione Granger had turned to the only person left she could talk to, the only person guaranteed to understand her point of view.
They're all mad,
said Hermione Granger as she strode vigorously toward Ravenclaw Tower, having left dinner a bit early.
Everyone except you and me, Harry. I mean, everyone except us in this whole school of Hogwarts. They're all entirely mad. And Ravenclaw girls are the worst. I don't know what Ravenclaw girls go reading when they get older, but I'm certain they ought not to be reading it. One witch asked me if the two of us had soul-bonded, which I'm going to look up in the library tonight, but I'm pretty sure has never actually happened.
I don't even know a name for this kind of fallacious reasoning, said Harry Potter.
The boy was walking normally, which meant he often had to skip forward a few steps to match her own indignation-fueled speed.
I seriously think if it was up to them, they'd be dragging us off this minute to get our names changed to Potter, Evans, Veris, Granger. Ugh, saying that out loud makes me realize how awful it sounds.
You mean your name would be Potter, Evans, Veris, Granger, and mine would be Granger, Potter, Evans, Veris,
said Hermione.
It's too horrible to imagine.
No, said the boy. House Potter is a noble house, so I think that name stays in front.
What?
Said Hermione indignantly.
Who says we have to...
There was a sudden, awful silence, broken only by the thuds of their shoes.
Anyhow,
Hermione said hastily,
some of the crazy things they said at dinner got me thinking, so I just want to say, Harry, that I really am grateful to you for saving me and everybody from getting beat up. And even though some parts of this afternoon upset me, I'm sure we can just talk about it calmly.
Ah,
Harry said with a faint and tentative smile, his eyes showing a mixture of befuddlement and apprehension.
That's good, I guess.
To be specific, there'd been the fourth-year witch explaining that since Harry was the evil wizard who'd fallen in love with Hermione, and Hermione was the pure and innocent girl who would either redeem him or get seduced by the dark arts herself, it followed that Hermione had to be perpetually indignant at anything Harry did, even if it was him heroically saving her from certain doom, just so that their romance wouldn't resolve itself before the end of Act Four. And then Penelope Clearwater, who Hermione had really thought was smarter than that, had remarked in a loud voice that for identical reasons it was impossible for Hermione to just go over and talk sensibly with Harry about why she was feeling hurt. And anyway, dark wizards were attracted to passionate defiance in women, not logic. This was the point at which Hermione had shoved herself up from the benches, stomped furiously over to where Harry was sitting, and asked him in a reasonable voice if the two of them could go for a walk and sort things out.
"So, in other words,"
Hermione said in her calmest voice ever,
"you're not really in trouble with me. I'm still talking to you. We're still friends, and we're still studying together. We're not having a fight. Right?"
Somehow, this only seemed to increase Harry Potter's apprehension.
"Right," said the boy who lived.
"Great,"
said Hermione.
"So, have you worked out why I was upset, Mr. Potter?"
There was a pause.
"You wanted me to keep out of your affairs?"
Harry said cautiously.
"I mean, I know you wanted to do things on your own, and I was staying out of your way until I heard you'd gotten ambushed by 3 junior Death Eaters, and honestly, I wasn't expecting that. Professor Quirrell wasn't expecting that. I started to worry you'd gotten in over your head, and then, no offence, Hermione, 44 bullies in a massed ambush is way beyond what anyone could handle without help. That's why I thought you really needed help. Just that once."
"No, that part's fine," said Hermione. "We were in over our heads, honestly. Please guess again, Mr. Potter."
Said Harry. "What Tracy did, startled you."
"Startled me, Mr. Potter?"
There might have been a touch of acidity in her voice.
"No, Mr. Potter, I was scared. I was frightened. I wouldn't want to admit to being afraid of just dragons or something. People might think I was cowardly. But when you can hear distant voices crying, 'Tekalili! Tekalili!' and there's pools of blood seeping out from under all the doors, then it's okay to be scared."
"I am sorry," Harry said with what sounded like genuine regret. "I thought you'd realize it was me."
"And the reason we all got scared like that, Mr. Potter, was that you didn't ask first."
Despite her intentions, Hermione found her voice was rising again.
"You should have asked me before you did something like that, Harry. You should have said very specifically, 'Hermione, can I make blood come out from under the doors?' It's important to be specific when you're asking about that sort of thing."
The boy rubbed the back of his neck as he walked.
I just thought you'd have to say no."
"Yes, Mr. Potter, I could have said no. That's the whole point of asking first, Mr. Potter."
"No, I mean, you'd
have had to say no, whether or not it was what you really wanted. And then all of you would have gotten beaten up, and it would have been my fault for asking first.
Hermione's eyebrows went up in a bit of surprise, and she kept walking for a few steps while she tried to understand this.
What?
She said.
Well,
the boy said a bit slowly.
I mean, you're the Sunshine General, aren't you? You couldn't say yes to me scaring people. Not even bullies. Not even to save your friends from getting beaten up. You would have had to say no. And then you would have gotten hurt. This way, you can tell people honestly that you had no idea and that it wasn't your fault. That's why I didn't warn you.
Hermione stopped walking, turned to face Harry full on instead of just turning her head. Her voice was very careful, even as she said,
Harry, you've got to stop coming up with clever reasons for doing stupid things.
Harry's eyebrows flew up. After a moment, he said,
Look, I know what you mean, of course, but there's still the question of whether it actually is a good idea, not just a clever one.
I understand why you did what you did today,
Hermione said.
But I want you to promise that from now on, you'll ask me first. Always, even if you can come up with a reason why you shouldn't.
There was a pause that stretched, and Hermione could feel her heart sinking.
Hermione,
Harry started to say.
Why?
The frustration burst out into her voice.
Why is it so awful? All you have to do is ask.
Harry's eyes were very serious.
Oh, in Spew, do you try the hardest to defend, Hermione? Who are you most afraid for when you fight?
Hannah Abbott,
Hermione said without having to think about it, and then felt a little bad because Hannah was trying hard, and she had improved a lot.
Would you feel okay about trusting someone else, like Tracy, with final responsibility for protecting Hannah? If you knew Hannah was about to walk into an ambush, and you came up with a plan for protecting her, would you feel good about letting Tracy say whether or not you were allowed to do it?
Well, no,
said Hermione, puzzled. The green eyes of the boy who lived were steady on hers.
Would you trust Hannah to have the final say in whether she needed protecting?
I,
said Hermione, and then paused. It was strange. She knew the right answer, and she also knew the right answer wasn't actually true. Hannah was trying so hard to prove she wasn't afraid, even though she was, and it was easy to see how the Hufflepuff girl might try too hard. Then Hermione realized the implication.
You think I'm like Hannah?
Not exactly.
Harry ran his hands through his mess of hair.
Listen, Hermione, what would you have suggested doing if I'd warned you about an ambush by 44 bullies?
I would have done the responsible thing and told Professor McGonagall and let her take care of it,
Hermione said promptly.
And then there wouldn't have been darkness and people screaming and horrible blue light.
But Harry just shook his head.
That's not the responsible thing to do, Hermione. It's what someone playing the role of a responsible girl would do. Yes, I thought of going to Professor McGonagall, but she would have only stopped the disaster once. Probably before any disturbance happened in the first place, like by telling the bullies she knew. If the bullies got punished just for plotting, it would be by losing house points, or at worst, a day's in detention, not anything that would really scare them. And then the bullies would have tried again. Fewer of them, with better operational security, so I didn't hear about it. They would probably ambush one of you alone. Professor McGonagall doesn't have the authority to do something scary enough to protect you, and she wouldn't have overstepped her authority because she's not really responsible.
Professor McGonagall isn't responsible?
Hermione said incredulously. She jammed her hands into her hips, now openly glaring at him.
Are you nuts?
The boy didn't blink.
You could call it heroic responsibility, maybe,
Harry Potter said.
Not like the usual sort. It means that whatever happens, no matter what, it's always your fault. Even if you tell Professor McGonagall, she's not responsible for what happens. You are. Following the school rules isn't an excuse. Someone else being in charge isn't an excuse. Even trying your best isn't an excuse. There just aren't any excuses. You've got to get the job done, no matter what.
Harry's face tightened.
That's why I say you're not thinking responsibly, Hermione. Thinking that your job is done when you tell Professor McGonagall, that isn't heroine thinking. Like, Hannah being beat up is okay then, because it isn't your fault anymore. Being a heroine means your job isn't finished until you've done whatever it takes to protect the other girls permanently.
In Harry's voice was a touch of the steel he had acquired since the day Fawkes had been on his shoulder.
You can't think as if just following the rules means you've done your duty.
I think,
Hermione said evenly,
that you and I might disagree about some things, Mr. Potter. Like whether you or Professor McGonagall is more responsible, and whether being responsible usually involves people running around and screaming, and how much is a good idea to follow school rules. And just because we disagree, Mr. Potter, doesn't mean that you get the final say.
Well, said Harry, you asked what was so awful about having to ask you first, and it was a surprisingly good question, so I examined my mind, and that's what I found. I think my real fear is that if Hannah is in trouble and I come up with a way to save her that seems weird or dark or something, you might not weigh the consequences to Hannah. You might not accept the heroine's responsibility of coming up with some way to save her, somehow, no matter what. Instead, you'd just carry out the role of Hermione Granger, the sensible Ravenclaw girl, and the role of Hermione Granger automatically says no, whether or not she has a better plan in mind. And then 44 bullies will take turns beating up Hannah Abbott, and it'll all be my fault because I knew, even if I didn't want reality to be that way, I knew that was how it would go. I'm pretty sure that was my secret, wordless, unutterable fear.
The frustration was building up inside her again.
It's my life,
Hermione burst out. She could imagine what it would be like with Harry messing with her all the time, constantly inventing justifications not to ask her first and not to listen to her objections. She shouldn't have to win an argument just to...
There'll always be some reason. You can always say I'm not thinking right. I want my own life. Otherwise, I'll walk away. I really will. I mean it, Harry.
Harry sighed.
This is exactly where I didn't want things to end up. And here we are. You're afraid of just the same thing I am, aren't you? Afraid that if you let go of the steering wheel, we'll crash.
The corners of his lips twisted, but it didn't look like a real smile.
That's something I can understand.
I don't think you understand at all,
Hermione said sharply.
You said we'd be partners, Harry.
That stopped him. She could see it stop him.
How about this? Harry said at last. I'll promise to ask you first before I do anything that could be interpreted as meddling in your affairs. Only you've got to promise me to be reasonable, Hermione. I mean really, genuinely.